All right, hello and welcome to Medi-Call episode 232. I'm Corey and here's Daryl.
Yo!
Yo, we are back at you, brought to you by ManaTraders.com. Use the promo code CardKnockLifePodcast _OA7. That's all one word, _OA7, which stands for Outrageous Authoritative 7, or Ostriches Angry 7. Man, I can't even make sense of that, so I'm not going to try anymore. OA7. That's the code, a Card Knock Life Podcast. 14% off your first 3 months at checkout, ManaTraders.com. Hey,
nice.
It's time to talk about Magic now.
It is.
So we got some spoilers from this new set. We got to dig into a little bit of those. Daryl, with general impressions on Kamigawa, what did you think about Kamigawa the first time around?
I was actually taking some time off when Kamigawa, the prequel, came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had some hyper-religious step-parents, and so that kind of put a nix on my Magic career for 4 years until I got back to college.
Oh, wow, okay.
I did not get to adventure to Kamigawa. So the Neon Dynasty, other than what I've seen from, you know, my legacy vintage modern playing days, is my first trip to actual Kamigawa and Standard. So
yeah, so for reference, Champions of Kamigawa, which was the first of the block, was 2004. That was like a real hit or miss set for me. You know, there's some really good
cards.
Was that the one that had
Jite that like was miserable or limited?
Jite was in Saviors or Betrayers?
It was one of those sets, obviously.
Whatever set Jite was in, it was in Betrayers. There was like almost nothing else good in it. So like Ninja the Deep Hours was in that set. But aside from that, I don't think there were like any rares that were very good, because there was like some really like specific to the set, like keyword mechanic stuff, like Ninjutsu like only works with ninjas, and like there were not ninjas outside of this set anywhere. So like Umezawa's Jite was like a great card, like super sought after, and it even came in a pre-con deck with rats, so you could get it for like $10, but the card itself was worth like $23 for a while, like, you know, when it was like in Standard. Obviously it's worth like, you know, something totally different now, but
yeah,
I just remember like when I wanted it, I was like shopping around all the Targets trying to find that one just like left on the shelf, because it was like, you know, you buy a brand new in that box of 100 cards for cheaper than you buy a single online, if I could just be lucky enough to come across it.
Did you win the GTA lottery there?
Never, but I looked for months and months and months. What did Champions have? Champions had a lot of great stuff. They're like Kiki Jiki, Umezawa's Jite, all the dragons. The Dragon Cycle was in there. Lava Spike, the Hondens were in there, the little ritual, the red ritual. There's lots of
Rite of Flame stuff. Or no, Desperate Ritual.
Yep. And then there's the Cycle of Lands that were legendary, and they could like untap a legendary creature type of thing. Yeah, lots of really cool
Shizo
stuff.
And crew, yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of the Dragon Cycle is back, baby. There's a new cycle of the dragons in the, what is the new one called? Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, right?
Neon Dynasty, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Azusa.
Or Neon Destiny, something like that.
Azusa is also in that set. Okay, sorry, I digress. Neon Dynasty is does Neo Tokyo mean anything to you? Where does that come from?
It's futuristic Tokyo.
Neo Tokyo. Okay, is that a good way to describe this, the theme of this?
Yeah. All right. It's 5,000 years in the future Japan. So yeah, Neo Tokyo is a very good description of it.
All right. Well, that's what I'm feeling. This Neon Dynasty is Neo Tokyo for me. So there you have it. The dragons that are being reprinted are clearly a cycle, because we've had the red one previewed for quite a while, and now just today we have a leak on the black one, which was the sought after one originally. Kokusho was a big deal when that was around. I think that was the chased dragon, Kokusho, and I was a big fan of Kaiga, but you know, Kokosho is going to steal games of Commander when that thing dies. But these ones are like even a little more powerful in some respects. So we'll talk about those when we get there. But first of all, I want to just kind of check in on what we've been playing in Magic. And then we'll kind of dig into our thoughts on the Neon Dynasty, Neo Tokyo spoilers, previews, et cetera, et cetera. So Daryl, sure, I know you've been getting into some Vintage. Why don't you throw that
I have
out?
Been. So kind of structurally, there are kind of a lot of pillar things that'll happen where like you'll see 10, 12, 14 of this of similar cards in most of these decks, unless you're kind of way off the beaten path. Just because things like, you know, the Moxen, Black Lotus, and then kind of you diverge from there. But, you know, if you're blue, it's Time Walk, Ancestral Recall, Brainstorm and Ponder. You know, all are kind of set up as one of. This is a nice little list of things. Demonic Tutor. Basically, if you think it's too powerful for a format, it's probable that it's a one of.
Yeah.
There's some kind of off the beaten path things like Narset, Parter of Veils, Karn, the Great Creator, that are one ofs. But I've been playing all sorts of decks kind of across that spectrum. I've been playing various like blue, like rug decks with kind of Oko and Renin 6. Everyone remembers this funness in Modern being a disaster. Well,
yeah.
Kind of, you know, toss in Strip Mine and stuff like that on top of it. And Moxen, and you kind of get one of the blue decks I've been playing, powered by, you know, recurring Ancestral Recall and Expressive Iteration and stuff like that. I played a few combo decks. I played a four-color version of the same deck that added black for Demonic Tutor. I played a few combo decks. I played a Fast Bond combo deck where you could deck your opponent and hold all of your counter spells in your hand for the rest of the game. So Fast Bond plus a Crucible effect, which I was using Ramen Up Excavator, lets you play lands from your graveyard, and if you have Zurn Orb, you can make infinite life and infinite mana. And so if you play the Canopy lands, you can draw your whole deck. If you have Mystic Sanctuary, you can recur all of your spells in your deck forever. Like, you can stack your deck, basically.
Yeah.
And then you can use Gush plus Mystic Sanctuary plus Fast Bond to draw your whole deck and draw the stacked spells, so you'll draw every counter spell, and then you can bolt your opponent to death or use Ancestral Recall to mill them out or whatever your, you know, desired functional ending du jour is for that deck. It's no real necessary extra cards that besides the Fast Bonds, the ones are in orb. I've been playing some blue Tinker decks. So Tinker is a restricted card, for those of you who don't know what it is. It's 2 and a blue sorcery. As an additional cost, sacrifice an artifact, search your deck for an artifact, put it into play. 99.9% of the time, you're tinkering for a Bolas's Citadel. And then you're pairing it with Sensei's Divining Top, so you can cast the spell off the top of your library for free or play the land off the top of your library for free if it's like a Solarian Academy or something you really need at the time. Otherwise, you're flipping your top and paying a life to just draw the next card and go one deeper and continue to turn through your deck until you hit, you know, Monastery Mentor plus Time Walk or Urza Saga plus Time Walk or Tendrils of Agony. Most decks aren't playing that anymore from the Storm structure, but those are kind of the ways you go about Bolas of Citadeling people to death. And then your backup Tinker target is Sphinx of the Steel Wind, because most of Vintage is Pyroblast and like things like Force of Vigor, which the Sphinx has protection from both of those things. So you just get to fly overhead for 6, and decks like Rug can't really answer it unless they have Dress Down plus Pyroblast. So kind of a tricky one to kill. And yeah. Then I kind of went off the beaten path and built some stuff on my own, one of which being a Jeskai Standstill deck. So basically, Standstill being the 2-mana enchantment that whenever a player casts a spell, sacrifice, and that player's opponent draws 3 cards. You can play Standstill on turn 1 with Moxen, and then get under it with Ragavan and Lavinia, the 2-mana Lavinia, and then just forcing your opponent to break Standstills, and then buying Lurrus out of your sideboard and recasting your Standstills or Ragavans to your heart's content to kind of just bury your opponent in cards and then beat them with, you know, your knuckleheaded 2-1s, 2-2s.
Oh man, Lurrus and Standstill is a whole another level of card advantage. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a whole nother ball of wax as far as like how unbelievably frustrating it is for your combo opponents when you just like you kind of have a, you might have like a Flusterstorm or a Power Blast in your hand, and then you play Standstill, and then they have to break it to try and like tinker. You draw Force of Will, and then you like buy your Lurrus, play it, cast Standstill, or
Yeah.
cast Black Lotus. Like, yeah, it's pretty miserable to like. If that engine is churning, you just kind of get bodied. But then there are just games that you win because you like dash Ragavan on turn one with a Mox and hit your opponent's Ancestral Recall and then cast it,
Yeah.
and that's fun, you know. So that sort of thing is happening. But kind of vintage is all over the map. The only real things that I haven't been touching are kind of the ones that I find boring, which is workshops and dredge. So something that's completely adjacent to Magic, but not really playing Magic, and then Mishra's Workshop decks, which is like a functional prison deck trying to power out like Sphere of Resistance and Thorn of Amethyst, Lodestone Golem to make your opponent's spells cost more, and then choking them with Wasteland and Ghost Quarter or Strip Mine, things of that nature. So
Yeah, vintage
that's kind of.
is a wild place to be. I mean, the like for those that are new here, this is a format where like you can have restrictions. Like to say that you can only play one of a card in your deck makes for like, some massive variety in some of these deck lists. And it makes me wonder like if they're gonna start experimenting with that in some of these online only formats. And like the rate at which they're introducing some of these kind of wild new formats in Arena, I wonder like this seems like some unexplored territory that will this remain exclusive to Vintage for so long? Like this could be kind of a cool way to approach some of these like really powerful cards from a different perspective. I don't know,
That's
maybe.
actually an interesting take on it. From the vintage perspective, like it's decks are kind of homogenous. Like when you get to like blue decks are pretty homogenous because like you play Recall, you play your Brainstorm, your Fluster or your Ponder, your Mox, the like on color Moxen and Lotus and Time Walk. So like you kind of get the same sort of like base cards that are kind of making the engine go with Force of Will and Flusterstorm to protect you from getting vintaged by Tinker or whatever. But like, yeah, from there you have, access to all of the dual lands. You have access to kind of all the dual fetch mana bases. So you can kind of pivot into whatever threat base you want, whether that be Oko or that be Tarmogoyf for Leovold or Deathrite Shaman. Like your threat base is kind of whatever you want it to be, which is really where you get the difference. It's kind of all, they call it blue soup. At least people that don't really like vintage because it feels kind of samey in that way. But it's kind of just like blue is the primary color to prevent you from getting, just tinkered or whatever, tendrils or paradoxical outcomed. And then you just kind of fill it in how to, what cards do you value more than others, whether it's like Assassin's Trophy or Pyroblast or Swords to Plowshares or Prismatic Ending. How do you want to fill out the rest of your deck?
So maybe
But I
the
do think.
variety is more of a product of like the wide like variety of cards that exist in the set or in the format, I should
Yeah,
say.
I think it's a derivative of kind of people's imaginations, really. Like, what cards do you think are efficient enough for vintage, or like, do you know of a way that you're trying to attack the format differently? Like, oftentimes things like Oath of Druids have been considered a rogue deck, where you'll play Oath of Druids with Forbidden Orchard that gives your opponent a spirit, then you can trigger your Oath of Druids and put some big monster into play, whether that's the new Hullbreaker Horror that like lets you bounce two Moxen and make it mana, or it's Griselbrand, or it's the new Sarah's Emissary, like whatever your big knucklehead of choice is. At one point it was like Emrakul with a Dragon's Breath, so you could give it haste and attack the turn you like milled the Emrakul. But like that's kind of a rogue deck. It's kind of ticked up a little bit, but like there are situations where the format is soft to certain things, and so you'll see those things pop up and do different sort of combinations. But I do think kind of you're, and I think it's a good time to segue to historic, like, and to alchemy or whatever direction you're going to go in here. It's, I think that the potential for utilizing restriction is an avenue that I think is very unexplored and could create some interesting gameplay. Like, if you see something that really does go off the rails, like, say we didn't know how good Uro was. and it was just in, historic or in whatever format we're talking about at this point.
Yeah.
You know, a restriction is, you know, it's not a bad way to leverage it. Like, and different decks can look to try and play a bunch of restricted cards, and you get away with that in Vintage because your mana is so good because you have duels and fetches and things like that. But, you know, maybe it's hard to build your mana base in something like Historic to support what your deck's trying to do and also give you access to, like, your one of restricted Uro that you sometimes draw and sometimes just don't. And so, like, you have to build your mana base this weird way to shoehorn power. Is that, you know, is that a worthwhile trade-off?
Yeah, it's like one of those things where like you can't count on seeing, you know, a copy of that card in 60 if it's only a 1 in 60 without like the support of all of these tutors like you have in Vintage. Yeah. So like in a format like Historic, we don't have, you know, we don't have the same kinds of tutor support. We have things like, I'm going to talk about Neoform in a second, and in similar, like, you know, much more powered down versions of those types of things. But to count on, like, okay, if Alrun's Epiphany is, like, the thing that my entire deck is based on, and there's not a whole lot of redundancy in, like, efficient, like, take extra turns cards, then, you know, like, the metagame starts to look a lot different because of that restriction, and you still get to play the card, but it's just, you know, something that's kind of, like, more, like, splashed in rather than being the basis of the whole deck. So, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could be interesting. Okay, absolutely. So... Yeah, to shift gears, what I've been playing a little bit of Historic. I haven't been playing a ton of Magic, to be honest with you guys, but what I have been playing is the Historic, and really especially, you know, experimenting with the Alchemy stuff. Historic hasn't been changed too much from Alchemy. I mean, compared to what my expectations of it were, there have been like some cards have kind of snuck their way in there, obviously, but you know, we talked about you know, how this was going to look entirely different after Alchemy appeared, and you know, there's not nearly as much. There's like, I should mention this one that's starting to pop up more and more often. There's this burn spell, and the name eludes me right now, but it's like one in a red for 2 damage to target creature or player. Let me see. I got to find this dang thing.
What else does it do?
And, yeah, I'm trying to find it so I don't say the wrong thing. That's all.
Oh, okay.
And what it does is the next time you play another spell, you get to take a card off the top of your library, and you can play it until end of the next turn, I think. Something along those lines. Oh, man, I'm butchering this right now. Here we go. Cha-cha-cha. All right. Well, anyhow, that's one that's seen play. Sure. But there is... The Inquisitor Captain is seeing a lot of play. There is the already very good Sacrifice decks got just boosted up, which is kind of a shame because those decks were already kind of like the creature decks of the format. But they got yet another one drop creature that has like sacrifice effects. So we're talking about like the Historic Golgari decks. They already had like the Gilded Goose, Cauldron Familiar, Witch's Oven Plan. They had Shambling Ghast and Ravenous Squirrel at one drops. They got to add an additional dude that is a 1/2. That dies and does even more things. It basically finds you a card from its spell book, which I'm not going to go through its whole spell book, but obviously there's 12 cards that are arguably pretty damn powerful for just free cards, free value added to your hand. Add Lurrus Loops into the mix, and you've got a whole bunch of shit to deal with. It's endless nonsense is what it is. So what I've been playing is a Historic Bant Captain deck built around Inquisitor Captain. And you know I love some good Enters the Battlefield triggers. Just as a refresher, Inquisitor Captain is the 3 and a white 3/3 Vigilance rare human cleric creature. Enters the battlefield if there are 20 or more creature cards with converted mana value 3 or less among cards in your graveyard, hand, or library, which this is always going to trigger if you build your deck, right? So it's a 3/3 Vigilance. Enters the battlefield. Seek 2 creature cards with mana value 3 or less, put one of them onto the battlefield, and shuffle the other into your library. So this deck also has in it four Charming Prince and four Glasspool Mimics. So there's a pretty strong chance that you're going to find one of those two to basically copy or reset your Inquisitor Captain. You can also find one of your four Soul Herders, which is historic legal, and blink your Inquisitor Captain. Or you can find a Grizzled Haunt Master, which this deck plays four of, and seek one of your last of four Inquisitor Captains from your sideboard to just start the loop all fresh. Now, we're also running four Neoform in the deck so that you can convert one of your many three drops into the Inquisitor Captain. So it's like anytime you get this guy online, all of a sudden your board state goes from 0 to 60. With any deck like this, it's like an aggressive start from your opponent could mean that, like, you know, any little bit of stumbling that you do, it's too hard to come back from. But there's like enough variety of ETB triggers in like the 1 to 3 drop range in historic that you can pretty much take care of like most of the problematic permanents and at least slow the spell decks down in historic with cards like Elite Spellbinder, Skyclave Apparition. We're running a Callous Blood Mage in this one to deal with their graveyards. The card is has black mana and its cost, which you can't actually cast from the deck, but you can get from a Neoform or just seek with the Inquisitor Captain. And then there's even more in the sideboard that you can get with the Hunt Master. So it's been a lot of fun to play this deck, and I've had some pretty damn good results with it too. So looking at the results on the historic metagame circuit right now, there's an awful lot of Phoenix still, which hasn't gotten really much of anything from Alchemy. The Golgari food deck I already talked about. And then Bant Captain is actually somewhere along the way, as well as like the Heliod combos deck, which also hasn't really gotten a big addition with Alchemy. So that's kind of where historic lies. This is sort of my favorite format to play right now. I'm kind of like taking a hiatus from modern. It's sort of hard to access modern, and I've sort of talked about that in previous episodes. But like I said, I get modern vibes playing historic, and the addition of Alchemy really feels like a Modern Horizons type of set for this like online format. And so like it gives me the opportunity to play this thing that's like kind of like seemingly exclusive to this environment. And I know it's not, because it's kind of like for the standard Alchemy as well, but it's these cards that are like super powerful that like I can really only get to here. Whereas like when I'm playing modern, like the only way I can really play those Modern Horizons cards, which I know they're available for like Legacy and Vintage, but who can afford that? that's kind of like that exclusive entry into that world of playing cards like Snapcaster Mage, or you know, whatever the cool like the Darcy's and things like that from the Horizons and Master sets are. So anyways, that's how I'm feeling about Magic right now, just kind of playing up the ladder with this and enjoying, especially the cosmetics. I think this is really it's really got a nice little visual element to it as well that gives you something to kind of work for, where you're not just like, okay, another 100 gold, I don't really care, but I'm checking those daily deals and I can see like where it's worth spending my gold and spending my gems and stuff like that. And kind of gives you some incentive to play well when there's not really much else going on there. If you're not going to play too hard into the tournament circuit. Okay. That said,
so
should we go on to Kamigawa?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. So just to wrap things up, there's only a couple of spoilers from Kamigawa right now. I do want to talk about the one from today first, though. There is a Dragon Legend, mono black Dragon Legend. I don't have this one ready. So let's put this one on hold. I take it back. I got you all ready for this one. We're going to start with the red one. I apologize. At Sushi, the Blazing Sky. This is the red one in the cycle. And it is 2 red-red for a 4/4 legendary creature, Dragon Spirit, Flying Trample. When Atsushi, the Blazing Sky, dies, choose one. And I'm guessing that this whole cycle is going to have this kind of like option mechanic, because this one and the black one both do. And this is unique to these because Kokusho, Kaiga, etc. did not. The two options are, one, exile the top two cards of your library until the end of your next turn. You may play those cards. Or two, create three treasure tokens.
I mean, this card is stupid in EDH.
Yeah.
It literally is just like an infinite combo by its enabler by itself. Like, Nim Deathmantle plus Ashnod's Altar gives you infinite mana, and then because you have the three treasures plus two mana from Ashnod's Altar, the Deathmantle is four mana, bring this thing back. You can just make infinite treasures and then use the infinite treasures to power the Deathmantle to infinitely exile your whole deck and cast all of the things, and yeah.
Your mind is always going to infinite combos, isn't it, Daryl?
I mean, I'm very used to playing Commander with people that like are like, how can we break this? And I just saw it, and I'm like, oh, well, you can just break this by making, like, it's like Worm Coil Engine in my brain. It's like, okay, this is broken in Commander with these cards that people just play in their Commander decks of that color anyways. So, like, just be ready for that to be a thing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, this one has a lot of value on the backside. Three treasures is big time. Three treasures alongside the, I can't remember the name of the dragon. The dragon that allows you to tap an artifact for mana pairs really
not
well.
Not Goldspan Dragon. I was like, I thought it was Goldspan Dragon.
Yeah, no, it is Goldspan Dragon, yeah. Isn't it?
No, Goldspan just makes your treasures tap for twice as much.
Treasures you control have tap, sacrifice their artifact, add two mana of any one color.
Yeah, yes. So right. Your treasures add an extra mana.
Yeah, it's the Prismari guy. Yeah. So There's a lot of dragon synergy in Standard to begin with, and I think this guy kind of slots right in there. Galazeth Prismari fits the bill. Two blue red, 3/4 flying, enters battlefield, create a treasure. Artifacts you control have tap, add one mana of any color, spend this ability to cast an instant or sorcery spell. That's what it is. So I think there's like a dragon control deck out there. I mean, there already is in Standard. This guy like seems to slot right in. It's yet another four drop, which like the deck is pretty stuffed at, but it's freaking good. I mean, a lot of these guys are legendary, so you can run like two or three ofs, and then now you can get more of them out on the board at one time.
I mean, from my perspective, really, like, it's kind of the modality that really helps you out here, because it's like, okay, you play this guy on turn three or turn four if you have, you know, turn three if you have a rock or something, turn four.
Yeah.
Turn four if you don't. And so what happens? So the guy, if it dies on turn four,
yeah,
either on your opponent's turn or your turn, you can just make two treasures and go straight to seven.
Yeah.
If it lives through turn four, well, now we have options. Yeah, we've got this 4/4 beater that's either going to draw us two cards, like nice little divination on our turn, or if we have enough instants and it dies on our opponent's turn, we can divination then too. Like, so it's kind of a debate of, well, you know, after turn four, like after the turn you play it, is where you start to get all the cash out value, right?
Yeah.
So I just think that'll be interesting to watch how people choose to cash out on this guy. Whether it's, you know, majority treasure, majority cards. Like, I would imagine that if you did a statistical analysis of like how the cash out happens on this creature, you're probably going to get 60-40 to treasures. But that if you were to subtract the turn that it died, you would probably get like 80-20 to cards.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine so. I mean, dude, like, and super aggressive on the front end. Like, so the cash out, just like for like a, like just to recoup the losses and like refuel in general, just if you're like, okay, this is the top end of like my burn deck even.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. Like a 4/4 flying trample is no joke. You can often chump the flying creatures, and that's, you know, that's a short lived situation, because eventually you're going to be you're not going to be able to like defend against a 4-power attacker in the air for too long. But with the trample, most of your chump blockers are going to be pretty worthless against anyway. Imagine you got some little spirits or something if we're in Kamigawa. So moving on to the next one, the one from today, and this is a leak. So this is kind of like a sketchy looking cell phone photo. So it looks very real though. I can't imagine this is fake. This is Junji, the Midnight Sky. And this is the black one in the cycle. 3BB for a 5/5 legendary creature, dragon spirit, flying in menace. When Junji, the Midnight Sky, dies, choose one. Each opponent discards 2 cards and loses 2 life. Or put target non-dragon creature card from a graveyard onto the battlefield under your control. You lose 2 life.
I mean, yeah. That first mode isn't even a mode.
What are you saying? The second one's too much better?
Oh, yeah. No, I can't ever imagine a world where I'm interested in that first mode.
Well, you don't have a target for the second one, maybe?
Okay, so sure, like if you get to the unfortunate circumstance where your opponent has, you know, spell bombed your graveyard or exiled all your creatures or whatever, then yes. But I can't think of a reality, like, does it do 2 to your opponent? Because like maybe if you need to nug them for the last 2,
the first they one have to does, discard yeah. their cards. Yeah,
so like maybe if you need to nug them for the last 2, but like overwhelmingly so. This to me looks like here's my 5/5 flyer. If you kill it, I'm going to bring back, you know, whatever the next best knucklehead is in my graveyard. And, you know, I'm playing this in a mid-range deck with chunky dudes, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. You're kind of, and you're damned if you do, damned if you don't with this guy. It's a 5-power flying menace. I mean, you can't really like just leave this on the board. You're dead in 4 attacks.
You can't really block it.
You can't block it
effectively.
But if you kill it off, I mean, discarding 2 cards and losing 2 life is not a joke. That's a significant blow. But just replacing it with something else miserable is terrible. I mean, this is a lot of value. This just reminds me of like all of the other like 5+ mana creatures that get printed into Standard these days, where it's like, oh, your opponents like survive that long in a mid-range deck, like they're gonna play something awful that you like just literally have to exile to, you know, not just feel terrible about it.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully they put the non-dragon clause on this. Otherwise, just looping 2 of these ad nauseum would be ugh.
Yeah, they thought that through. It does say, and just to be clear, it does say from a graveyard, so you can take something from your opponent's graveyard.
Oh my god! Yeah. I hear that part.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
So all That's right, good. Let's move on to. There's only a couple more here. The Planeswalker is interesting. It's 1BB for Kaito Shizuki. And 3-mana planeswalkers have to be looked at. We've seen a lot of busto ones in the past, right? So this is a 3-loyalty planeswalker. At the beginning of your end step, if Kaito Shizuki entered the battlefield this turn, he phases out. Okay. +1, draw a card, then discard a card unless you attacked this turn. -2, create a 1/1 blue ninja creature token. This creature can't be blocked. -7, you get an emblem myth. Whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, search your library for a blue or black creature card, put it on the battlefield, then shuffle.
Okay. Okay. It's a really interesting emblem. This card doesn't really do anything.
Draws you cards. It gives you ninjas for ninjutsu. Obviously what it's for, right?
Yeah.
And then the phasing out is really unusual. So phasing out protects itself, right? If it enters the battlefield this turn, he phases out. So you can put the ninja into play, get him down to 1 loyalty, and then just poof, he's gone and survives through the next turn to do the +1.
Could you read that one more time? Could you read that trigger one more time, please?
It says at the beginning of your end step, if Kaito Shizuki entered the battlefield this turn, he phases out. So the first time when you first play him, he phases out.
Yep, I thought it was like when he enters the battlefield, and I was like, that seems very pointless. Okay, I'm more content with this now.
So basically, it's almost like he's a one loyalty planeswalker that comes with a ninja and then disappears for a second.
Yeah.
With the option of doing it a different way if you really want to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the tough part is just, like, can you, like, if only we had some good counter doubler, because then you could just, like, ultimate this thing, because it hides itself, because it's, like, minus seven, right? So it's 3 plus 1, the double counters makes it 7, and it hides itself so you can't kill it, and then you can ult it and, like, go to town.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's no good counter doublers in Standard, unfortunately. Or fortunately, I'm not sure, you know, which one we really want to say there. But yeah, that could be kind of impressive.
It's weird because it doesn't have any ability that deals with problem permanents or creatures, which almost every planeswalker has, like a draw card or like create a dude and then remove something. And so this doesn't have that. And so, like, I don't know how you're getting up to 7 with this guy. I mean, you're just going to be constantly drawing cards and attacking with creatures. Like, it seems very unlikely that that's the case unless your opponents are literally ignoring it. But I don't think it's a bad card. I think it's interesting. It definitely just, like, you know, it's going to, like, last for a little while, probably be attacked to death and fizzle out, but it'll provide maybe enough value for it to just be worth it as, like, a divination plus a dude or something.
Yeah. Totally fair.
An unblockable dude at that. That's non-zero. Okay. Yeah. And then last one from this bunch that I think we should talk about, because I don't think it's worth going over this Hidetsugu guy right now. First of all, the lands are freaking beautiful. You've seen these, right, Daryl? The basics?
Yeah, gorgeous.
Yeah, they're amazing. Satoru Umezawa, like, if you're into Commander, like, you have to be interested in this guy. Like, first of all, there's 3 different alternate arts for it, and they're sweet. The card does this. It's 1 blue-black for a 2/4 legendary creature, human ninja. Whenever you activate a ninjutsu ability, look at the top 3 cards of your library, put one of them in your hand, and the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. The ability triggers only once each turn. But each creature in your hand has ninjutsu 2 blue-black.
Yeah.
So this is going to be like a new Kalia type of general for blue and black, I think, because, like, just to sneak these, like, big beefy creatures into play for just 4 mana seems kind of ridiculous.
So I think there's also a very important piece of that you accidentally overlooked.
Uh-huh.
Which is that the creature you're sneaking into play is completely unblocked.
Yeah.
Because ninjutsu requires the creature not to be blocked. So if you happen to have something like Blightsteel, your opponent is just dead on the spot. Like, they can try and kill it, but if they don't have a removal spell, they're dead on the spot. They don't get to go back and block. Like, none of that nonsense. Dead. So, like, people are going to be like, all right, what are my one shots? Or, like, what's a creature that, like, if I hit with this, I get to draw a bunch of cards or some nonsense like that?
Yeah.
Or my opponent discards their hand, or, like, just heinous bullshit, basically.
Yeah, so I can't imagine, like, playing this guy would be very entertaining unless you're just, like, winning in one attack, because you're going to be a must kill. Like, it feels that way with Kalia. And I always feel bad playing against my buddy who has a Kalia deck, because he plays the Kalia and then everyone's head turns and you're like, well, I guess we have to kill that thing, you know? Cause it's like, yeah, we can't let it attack because you're just going to throw something awful out on the board. And then we just have more problems to deal with. So he feels bad every time his Kalia dies and he has to keep paying 2 extra mana to put it back into play. But, like, what are we going to do? Just let it, let it do nasty things to us. You know, it cannot remain on the battlefield. So this guy, for example, is like, it doesn't even need to be in play for a whole go around. It doesn't give you the opportunity to say, oh, by the way, that guy played a Satoru Omazawa last turn, because if you've got seven mana free, you just have to put it into play and then attack with something else.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, big time target that needs to die before combat.
Uh-huh. Sure does. Yeah.
Problematic. And you're in blue too, so you've got counter spells to back it up if you really want to go that route.
Oh yeah. That's definitely gonna be a thing. Yeah. Like, people are definitely gonna play this as like a tempo deck where it's like, play your stupid 1 and 2 mana unblockable creatures, this thing, cheat your just giant fat dummies into play, and like, it's not better for like a competitive style deck than Edric.
Yeah.
With your 1 and 2 drop dummies, but like, it's just a kind of another a sideways angle on Edric.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of the way I look at it. That instead of playing, you know, instead of getting to just draw infinite cards, you just get to put giant monsters into play.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that is the last card that there really is out there. There's the Hidetsugo. We can talk about that guy next time, but again, I don't think he's really too much to write home about right now. But yeah, there you have it. I mean, that's some flashy stuff. We got a pretty promising set so far. And I think the theme is really fun and colorful. And you know, for those that were like kind of on the fence about Kamigawa to begin with, it's hard not to be entertained by it, at the very least entertained by this stuff, because it's like, there's a lot to look at here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Take it easy, everybody.
Goodbye.
Modern Metacall is a production of CarnockLife.com, where you can find a selection of MTG content, both written and recorded. Looking for deck primers? We've got them. Interested in videos? Try our CKL Play series, where we take the most interesting decks appearing in published results for a spin through MTGO leagues. We've got a team of talented writers specializing in a variety of formats and archetypes. To keep up with Cardnock Life offerings, you can follow us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/CardnockLifePodcast. Thanks is due to ManaTraders.com, MTGCast.com, and TheDiscard.com for their support in making this possible, and thank you for listening, commenting, sharing, and reading Cardnock Life content.